Thank you, Mr. Miller. Good afternoon, everyone. Well, Mr. Rusnick left me a lot of time, so I guess we can go the full time of a regular sermon, right? Just kidding, brethren. Just kidding. I would like to begin today by asking you three questions. Is there anyone here who ever took a picture? Now, I'm not talking about just with your cell phone, with these kind of automatic pictures now with, digital technology. I mean in the old days where we had film and flash bulbs and things like that. Anybody remember taking pictures? Okay. Second question. Has anyone here ever participated in the foot washing service at Passover? A lot of hands out there. Good. Third question, and you don't need to raise your hand on this. Have you ever felt that perhaps you did not fully understand everything that Jesus Christ was teaching his disciples through the foot washing service at the Passover? Well, I'll raise my hand on this one, because that's kind of the point of this split sermon. And if you were tempted to raise your hand also, well, stick with me for the next 35 minutes or so, and hopefully we can all come to a little greater understanding. Let's begin with some groundwork. Some of the veterans in the church here will remember my father from way back in the 60s when he first started attending in Akron up at the old Northern Building. Well, my dad, before he retired, was a professional photographer. And I can remember as a little boy around the dinner table at night, Dad would tell us, you know, the events of the day, what transpired at work. And a lot of you do that kind of thing too, I'm sure. And I can remember on multiple occasions my father telling an incident that sounded kind of like this. One of the executives came into the photo lab and he said, "Lou, I've got something for you here." And in his hand was a couple little film canisters. He said, "I shot these pictures on my vacation up in Canada last week. And oh, I'll tell you, they're probably going to be some real beauts. I'd appreciate it if you could develop that film and print me some nice glossies. Oh, you're in for a real treat, Lou." And with that, he was on his way, all smiles, all happy. But my father was not smiling. Inside, he was cringing. Because my father proceeded to tell all of the family, this man was a terrible photographer. So my dad began the long, arduous, and even painful process of developing the film, developing the negatives, and trying to print some decent pictures. "Oh," Dad said, "the negatives were terrible." "Well, remember, I'm 10 years old. I said, well, Dad, how could the negatives be terrible? What was wrong with them?" And so Dad proceeded to tell him. He said, "Well, first of all, this man was using the wrong speed film for the conditions involved. He must have been shooting with his aperture wide open. Entirely wrong f-stop. Why, the depth of field was completely gone." "Wow, that's a lot to throw at a 10-year-old, I thought. Wrong speed film? Well, even a 10-year-old knows that film isn't fast or slow. A runner is fast. A runner is someone that has speed, not film. And depth of field? Well, a well is deep, not a field. A field is flat. And f-stop? Well, even I knew that. That's when your teacher says, 'You didn't do well on that test, Scott. You're going to get an F.' And I said, 'Oh, stop. Don't do that.'" Well, needless to say, these concepts right over yours truly's head. "I'm going outside to play, Dad. See you later." Well, fast forward 10 years. Yours truly goes to college. I take an elective, Photography 101. Took some pictures, worked in the darkroom, actually got my hands down in the chemistry. You know, made some pictures, and I'd come home on the weekends, and I'd show my father what I had done. And my dad, he would smile and encourage me. "Did I learn to be a great photographer?" "No, but I learned the basics. I learned that after you snapped the shutter, there was a whole lot more that happened behind the scene, And in the dark room, that's why my father had cringed, because it was all that dark room work that was so terrible for this executive who didn't know what he was doing behind the camera. And so my father and I were now able to discuss some of these things. And he told me, he said, "Do you remember years ago when I would tell you about this or that?" And I said, "Yes, I do remember." And we had a common frame of reference. I could now begin to understand some of these things. I could understand them. Well, I have just spent about 6 minutes telling you a very detailed scenario here. A detailed scenario outlining a situation in which one person attempts to explain to a second person something which is foreign or unfamiliar to that second person. We're going to need that in just a minute. What does that have to do with foot washing at the Passover? Well, much more than we might readily recognize. If you're looking for a title today, I've simply called this Foot Washing. Don't miss the point. Now, we may be familiar with foot washing at the Passover, but how often during the rest of the year do most of us wash the feet of another person? Unless you're a parent with small children whom you're bathing daily, or unless you're a caregiver for someone who's elderly or infirmed, probably not very often. For most of us, it's just one time a year, and that happens at Passover. Why is that? Because today, we live differently here in northeastern Ohio than did Jesus Christ and his disciples in Jerusalem now nearly 2,000 years ago. How many of you walked here today? I don't see any hands out there. Most of us just walked maybe from the garage or from the house to the garage or across the driveway. How many of you got your feet dirty coming here today? Again, I don't see hands out there. Most of our walking was probably on concrete or blacktop, maybe a little bit of gravel. All the men with whom I've spoken today, they're like me, wearing shoes, probably socks. Ladies, you're wearing shoes. I think most all you ladies are probably wearing stockings. Some of you may have decided to go bare-legged. But regardless, unless you stepped in a puddle out there from last night's rain, it is highly unlikely you got your feet dirty coming here today. Well, it wasn't like that 2,000 years ago in the Middle East. You've read the articles, you've seen the movies, you've heard the sermons. You know, we all do, that back then, they walked nearly everywhere they went. Roads were dusty and dirty. They wore sandals, no socks, no stockings. Their feet got dirty. And as a result, foot washing was a very common practice when and where Jesus Christ lived and walked on this earth. Let's begin the scriptures in Luke 7, reading verses 36 to 39. Luke 7, verses 36 to 39. Speaking of Jesus here, "Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And Jesus went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when one of the Pharisees who had invited him saw it, he spoke to himself, saying, 'This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And then skipping ahead to verse 44. Speaking again of Jesus, then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with the tears and wiped them with the hair of her head." Did you notice the implication in Jesus' words? If Simon had offered Christ water, Jesus would not have refused it. He wouldn't have said, "Well, what's the meaning of this? What am I to do with this?" No, indeed, he would have known, because foot washing was customary. It was a common event of everyday life. But that's not so today, here in the Western world, here in northeastern Ohio. It's been a number of years now since Sherry and I finished our renovations and remodeling in our house. And the last step inside was carpet. And along with the carpet came a household rule: no shoes in the house. And so I've asked many visitors since that time to kindly remove their shoes. Please leave them at the door. Come inside on the carpet in your stocking feet. What comments, what responses have I received? A lot of people have said something like this: "Oh, that's fine, Scott. We do the exact same thing at our house too." There have been others who have said, maybe that's what we should do too, and our carpet would still be in better shape. When we had furniture delivered, I remember the delivery man on the porch. He said, "Well, our paperwork here says you want us in our stocking feet. We'll leave our shoes right here at the door." Nobody resisted. Nobody argued. No one said, "Well, why do you want us to remove our shoes?" Why do you think that was? Well, personally, I believe it's because it's a very common and customary practice in the Western world today. And even if people don't remove their shoes in their own home, they've probably been someplace else where the host or hostess has asked them to do that very thing. And so it didn't seem like it was out of the question, like it was something that was inappropriate. But brethren, I tell you, I have never greeted a guest and said, "Please, sit down, remove your shoes. But don't stop there. Your socks, too, your stockings. And I'll be right back with a basin of water, and you can wash your feet. I'm sure you'll be much more comfortable after that." Can you imagine the reaction I'd probably receive? I can just imagine looks of shock and disbelief, thinking, what are you asking, Scott? Imagine some people could really be offended. That was the point of the introduction today. We spent a lot of time on that, and it was important, because that was an illustration that when one person is confronted by something with which he or she is unfamiliar, a great deal of the meaning and insight and understanding may escape from his or her comprehension. And unless we are extremely careful, a great deal of the understanding and meaning behind Jesus Christ's actions when he washed his disciples' feet can slip right past us. It's not enough to simply go through the motions without giving deep thought and considering both the literal action of Jesus Christ in washing his disciples' feet and the culture of the time. Those things fit together, hand in glove, or maybe in this case I should say, foot in sandal. Let's turn over, please, to the book of John, and we'll turn to chapter 13, and let's read the actual foot washing service as recorded here in the book of John. We're going to read verses 4 through 17. In John 13, starting in verse 4, Jesus rose from supper and laid aside his garments. He took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, "You are not all clean." Continuing in verse 12, "So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord. You say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example. You should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him." In verse 17, "If you know these things, happy are you if you do them." There's a lot in that account. Let's go back to verse 12. That's where Christ raised the question, "Do you know what I have done to you?" This was not just a rhetorical question, because Peter could have easily said, "Well, of course I know. You washed my feet. I argued with you about it. I wasn't going to allow it at first. Remember?" In verse 7, Christ had stated that he knew they did not understand yet, but he told them they would later. Why is that, that they were going to understand later? Well, there were two things yet to come that the disciples did not yet have. That was conversion, the gift of the Holy Spirit, and also Christ's words that followed the foot washing. Let's reread some of those words, kind of reordering some of those verses. Verse 13, Jesus said, "You call me teacher and Lord. You say, well, for so I am." Verse 16, "Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than him who sent him." Verse 14, "If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." In verse 15, "For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you." And finally, in verse 17, "If you know these things, happy are you if you do them." Christ told his disciples he was clearly the master. The master was clearly greater than the servants. And the master was willing to serve the servants. So the disciples should do likewise and also be willing to serve others. And the end amount, the end part of the story was, if we know these things and do them, happy are we. In John 13:7, Christ plainly told his disciples they did not understand yet what he was doing and why he was doing it when he washed their feet. But they would. And as I mentioned, two elements would come that would provide that understanding. Their conversion, remember, had to wait to Pentecost until the Holy Spirit would be given to them. But also these verses of explanation in verses 13 to 17. "Brethren, we have those two things. Anyone who's going to participate in the Passover service tomorrow night has to be baptized. He or she should have God's Holy Spirit. We've just read these verses. We should be able to understand too, right?" Well, in reality, brethren, There is something we do not have. The disciples had that something 2,000 years ago that we don't have here today. And that's a familiarity with the practice of foot washing, because it was a common occurrence of everyday life for them when they walked the earth with Jesus Christ. But it's not for us. Remember, we've already discussed the fact. We're not walking on the dusty roads. We're not getting our feet dirty in the same way. And when people come to my house, I ask them to remove their shoes, but I never offer them a basin of water, because it's not a common occurrence for us today, the way we live. And as a result, we don't have the same understanding of that action that they did 2,000 years ago. And Jesus chose foot washing as a practice of everyday life to illustrate a point and teach his disciples critically valuable lessons about humility and service. Recall how adamant Peter was in verse 8 of John 13, saying, "You shall never wash my feet." That was a declarative statement. He was really convicted. He was saying, "No way, God, no way, Jesus, you're not going to do it. It's not going to happen." Why? He clearly thought it would be wrong for Jesus, the Son of God, the Creator of this world, to assume such a menial position, kneeling on the floor at the feet of his servants, washing their feet. The Son of God doing that. Because Peter understood that Christ would be putting himself in the position of the lowest of the low. You know, I remember something that Mr. Pinella, it's hard to believe, he's been dead now for almost 20 years, our former pastor in Canton. But I remember he emphatically emphasized over and over again, foot washing was a task that was always relegated to the lowest level servant in the household, if the household had servants. It wasn't the cupbearer, the greatest of the servants. It was the least. And that was the role Jesus Christ assumed. Now, we can very easily read this account today and tell ourselves, "Oh, I think I understand this." But personally, I've long wondered, do we really? Do we really? Let's regroup for just a minute. We began this message with a story to illustrate the fact that when one person is confronted by something with which he or she is unfamiliar, there's a substantial risk that much of the meaning is going to slip past and not be understood. And we've also established that foot washing was common during Christ's time on the earth, but not for us today. Could recognizing this fact somehow help us to more fully understand the foot washing service? Well, maybe so. How? Well, personally, I can guarantee each and every one of you adults that you've all had an experience like mine, like the one I described earlier about, you know, the photos and about my dad's trying to explain that to me. You've had an experience where someone tried to explain to you something that was new and something with which you were unfamiliar, and the details just didn't seem to make sense. And then, at some point, the light bulb clicked on, and you did understand. Think back for just a moment, back on your life, because I guarantee you, you've had an experience like that. Perhaps someone was trying to teach you something. Perhaps some of you women were learning to sew, to knit or crochet, and you just couldn't get onto this idea of dropping a stitch. The whole thing unraveled. Maybe you were learning to cook or to bake. Maybe some of you men were learning to garden or landscape. Maybe woodworking. Maybe engine repair. And you just couldn't get onto this concept about compression ratios. Just didn't make any sense to you. Maybe you were learning to play a musical instrument. I mean, the list of possible situations is truly endless. But I feel confident we've all been there. We've all had that situation where something was just totally foreign to us, and then at long last, we understood. How can that help us? Well, find that experience in your mental diary, your mental memory bank. Recall the feeling when suddenly that light bulb did click on. And what that will do is to personally remind each and every one of us that what I've just been telling you is true. When we're confronted by something that is unfamiliar with us, something that we don't understand, there's a substantial, serious risk that a lot of the meaning just going to go right over our heads. We won't understand it. Just like me trying to listen to my father when I was 10 years old about the dark room. Why is that important now? Because tomorrow night, we're going to take the Passover and participate in the foot washing service. It's just a day away. And it's important for us to be prepared and to make sure that we have as great an understanding of this precious action. How can we do that? How can we do everything we can to make sure we're ready? Well, I think there are three things. Turn with me, please, to the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 30. I'd like to read a couple verses from the reign of King Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 30, verses 18 and 19. This was back at the time when the Passover and the Holy Days had not been properly observed in Israel for many years, and Hezekiah was instituting reforms. In verse 18, we read, "A multitude of the people, many from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover contrary to what was written. But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, 'May the good Lord provide atonement for everyone.'" And in verse 19, he specifically says, "Everyone who prepares his heart to seek God." Hezekiah here was stressing the importance of preparing our hearts to seek God. That's exactly what we want to do, what we need to do as we prepare our hearts to take the Passover and to seek understanding from God. How? Well, we need to begin by recognizing that perhaps we have not fully understood and appreciated the practice of foot washing. Because as I've said repeatedly, it's foreign, it's unfamiliar to us. And maybe, just maybe, we haven't really understood it. Next step? Well, the scriptures are replete with instructions. Pray about it. Ask God to grant understanding. Old Testament, New Testament, take your pick. God says He'll give understanding to those who seek it. But I think there's one more thing that we can do personally to increase our understanding of this precious action of foot washing. What if we try to consider foot washing not from our perspective here, 21st century, northeastern Ohio, but from the perspective of someone who was taking the Passover in Jerusalem back in A.D. 32, the year following Christ's death and resurrection? What if we'd put ourselves in the position of someone who was coming there in the New Testament church to participate in that service? That would be for someone for whom foot washing would not be a foreign practice. Well, what does the Bible tell us about the people that would have been gathered there that first Passover following Christ's resurrection? Well, for that, we can turn to the book of Acts, chapter 1, and in verse 15, we can begin to gain some understanding about who might have been there that night. In Acts 1 and verse 15, In those days, Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples. Altogether, the number of names was about 120. We know the church had started with about 120, but then fast forwarding over to chapter 2, verse 41, we begin to read about growth. Then those who gladly received the word were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added. And that continued. The church was growing. So we know that there were a few thousand people in the church, would have been there for Passover, A.D. 32. What happens now that can tell us about those people? Well, the Apostle Paul tells us something about who made up the church in 1 Corinthians 1, verses 26 to 28. 1 Corinthians 1, 26 to 28. Paul states, "For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things that are despised God has chosen." Well, Paul says, weren't many of the mighty that were called. Mainly, they were the weak, the lowly, the base. We sing about that in one of our songs. But it's interesting, Paul said, not many of the rich and the famous, the mighty, were called. But he didn't say none. He said, not many. Well, is it possible then that some of the few, some of the rich, some of the powerful were called? Well, I think that's a pretty obvious conclusion for us to reach. Is it possible that some of those who were baptized during this year that has passed from Christ's resurrection until Passover the following year, is it possible that some of those who have been baptized and come into the church perhaps would be some of the wealthy masters, some of those that had servants? Well, I think that's a fair assumption. Paul tells us not many, but a few. How about some of those who would have been servants? Well, he tells us very plainly, yeah, most were the base, the lowly. What if we focus on the foot washing service that year, looking at two people? One of the few, a master who's wealthy, and his lowly servant. They're the only two from that household who came into the church. What if we look at foot washing from their perspective? Let's imagine them coming to the foot washing service at that Passover, the year following the last that Christ observed with his disciples. Let's begin on I'll say the good side. Let's imagine each one of you that you're one of the few. You're not one of the Marines, not the few, the proud. God doesn't like the proud. One of the few, one of the wealthy. So you're the master. And you and your servant come to the Passover servant. You begin, you sit down in the chair. And your servant kneels at your feet. And he or she proceeds to wash your feet, just as he or she does every day. Done it 100 times before. Doesn't feel much different from just being at home, day-to-day basis, does it? But now, you trade places. What goes through your mind? You're the one now, kneeling before your servant. The one that you employ. The one that takes care of you. You're kneeling there, and you're washing his or her feet. It's a new experience for you. You've probably never done anything like this before in your life. But now it's time to flip the coin over. Because I was wrong before. Paul was right. Not many of the wealthy and the mighty are called. And guess what? You're not one of them. You're the servant. The wealthy, the mighty master, he or she's the one that walks with you humbly. Well, you walk humbly behind your master, into the Passover service. Same as before, master sits in the seat, you kneel, you prepare to wash your master's feet. This is just like you do on your job every day at home. You don't really look up to pay attention to your master, you just pay attention to what you're doing. But then something happens. Your master reaches down and touches your cheek. And he or she turns your face to look into his or hers. And you see your master smile at you. And you hear your master softly say, "Thank you." Kind of takes you aback. Now it's time to trade places. You're still the servant. You sit in the seat. Your master kneels at your feet. You feel a little uncomfortable, a little awkward at first. This has never happened to you before in all your life, because you've always been a servant, probably even from your youth. And here's someone washing your feet. But not just someone, your master. Your master. You try not to splash water on your master's robe. And you might even try to pull your foot out of the basin a little bit to say, well, that's enough, that's enough. But your master doesn't allow it. Your master seizes your foot by the heel and firmly pulls it back into the water and gently whispers, "I'm not finished yet." And then your master proceeds to wash your feet thoroughly, not ceasing until he or she has dislodged every last grain of sand from between your toes. And then when finally finished, your master, the one who provides you with your food, your shelter, all your worldly needs, your master softly smiles again and says to you, "It has been my pleasure to serve you tonight." What thoughts pass through your mind? This scenario depicts two people not just washing feet, but two people learning precious lessons about humility and about service, about conversion. These are the lessons Jesus intends for you and me to learn too. We dare not miss the point. Jesus instituted the foot washing service at Passover to teach his followers deeply meaningful lessons. We dare not allow these lessons to skip past us. Don't allow the foot washing service to become a meaningless ritual. It's nearly upon us. Let us all endeavor to be in the proper attitude for the foot washing service. And may we all have a deeply meaningful Passover.